Hello and welcome to the Marketing Meetup Podcast. My name is Joe Glover. Thank you so much for listening today. I am literally just off the back of recording the webinar with Kendra McDonald, the CEO of Automation Ninjas. Kendra brought the energy this morning. She was on fire, and so was the chat feature as well. People absolutely loved this talk. People calling it the best webinar they've ever attended, the best webinar they've attended this year, and all sorts. It was really, really great. Kendra speaks about neuroscience and marketing, and in this talk, then she outlines a number of cognitive biases that marketers may fall foul of in our efforts. Kendra uses this knowledge to help us be more friendly to our customers, to help us convert more, but in a way, in a direction which is useful to the people we're trying to help rather than look to manipulate or self-serve. I really loved this talk for a couple of reasons. Kendra's energy was phenomenal, but also the knowledge presented, even though it came at 100 miles an hour, which is a very positive thing in this circumstance, was really, really useful. I've got pages and pages of notes. I'm absolutely buzzing off the back of it. I know that you're going to love today's chat. I don't even need to say I hope you do. I know you will. I think it's great. Two things for me before I hand over to Kendra. The first is today's featured sponsor is Geosk. As we were speaking about conversion and converting, then Geosk is a Finnish-based company with a phenomenally powerful tool to help your website quickly and easily convert more people. The way that they do that is through their interaction designer, which makes it super easy to make changes to your website on the fly. That acts as a lovely overlay, and honestly, it's great. It's really, really good. We use it on our website and have been very pleased with it. The second thing to say is that there is some swearing in this podcast. So if you do not like swearing, then this may be one to sit out. Although I really hope you don't, because the content is well worth it. It really is, and the way that Kendra uses swearing is very much in a way that's productive and to make a point. So if that's not you, that's okay. But I'd really encourage you to stick through nonetheless. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. In fact, I know you will, and I will see you soon. Enjoy.
All right, guys. Yes, it is 8:30-ish in the morning, and we are getting into neuroscience. Even better than that, we're getting into cognitive bias, which I'm super excited about. And I love seeing how everybody is really going in the chat. This is going to keep me amped. I've actually got the chat window open so that it's scrolling on my big screen so that I can see you guys. So, you know, I'm excited. All right, guys. So let's get into it. So we're literally talking about cognitive bias this morning. We're going to tap a little bit into some of the neuroscience that helps consumers convert, but we're also going to take a look at what stops consumers from converting, which is really, really important that we make that understanding and that distinction. So although Joe's already an amazing intro, here's another picture of my face, because obviously we need to see two of me in the morning. So I am Kendra McDonald, as Joe said, founder and CEO of Automation Ninjas, and we're an agency that specializes in behavioral marketing automation. So I bring my background in forensic psychology into marketing and just help you guys understand a little bit about how the brain works. I also wrote Hack the Buyer Brain, which is all about how we evolve to survive, not to buy things online, and the implications that that has for your marketing. But really what I spend most of my day doing is building out customer journeys and implementing them in marketing automation. And a lot of the time when I'm having those conversations about how we take that and apply it to unique and individual businesses, we're not just talking about how the brain goes about making those purchase decisions. We're also talking about what goes wrong when the brain makes those purchase decisions. So we need to remember that when someone is going through a purchasing process, when they're going through that buying process, they are making a decision. And when they are making a decision, we have to remember that decisions are complicated. We're not just actually going through the process of decision-making when someone is purchasing, but we're also problem-solving. So we're understanding exactly what we need to think about in terms of consequences. When we are making actual judgment statements, we're trying to figure out what the accuracy of that decision might be for us. And when we are going through this whole process, we undertake deductive and inductive reasonings. You guys ready to get into the nitty-gritty? So deductive reasoning is when we reason based on something that we know is true. So deductive reasoning is something, if we know 100% that that thing is true, we can decide whether it's right or wrong. Whereas inductive reasoning is when the brain takes shortcuts and it makes generalizations about something. So when you're making a decision, you've got all of this going on. You've got your problem solving, you've got your judgment, and you've got your reasoning that's happening all at the same time. So any kind of business decision, especially the more complicated and longer drawn out B2B decisions, or for B2C, the bigger, more complex processes where there's lots that are going to be happening, there is a ton happening that your brain is going to be doing. And the whole time through this, the brain is not your friend. It's not making the best decisions for you. And now this comes down to our own brains, but it also comes down to our consumers' brains. And the problem with this is the fact that the brain is geared for survival. It's not geared to make really complicated and complex decisions. The brain is geared to do things like when you're in a forest and suddenly all of the birds stop singing, it's probably a predator nearby. Okay, that's the point where you need to be concerned. That's the type of stuff that the brain is really, really worried about. It's not necessarily worried about day to day, you know, if I buy this house, is it a really good investment for me? If I make this career change, if I purchase this piece of software. So the brain is really utilizing older systems for modern survival. And that's just, you know, how we've evolved to utilize for today. So one of the ways that our brains are bad is that effectively, your brain is lazily saving calories. So remember, from an evolutionary standpoint, it doesn't want to use calories. You use calories, you reduce your chances of survival. I want my brain to use more calories, but it ain't going to do that. So it will do things like hill climb. And that means it'll substitute smaller goals for a bigger goal. So rather than making a decision about which marketing automation platform is the best platform for you, it's going to go, I like the branding of that brand, of that company better. So I'm going to choose that one. Right. So that's an example of hill climbing, where it substitutes a goal that you may not actually want it to substitute for, because it's slowly climbing up the hill towards the thing that you want. So our brains are going to do weird things like that all the time. It'll also transfer and conflate. So it'll transfer lots of stuff from previous experiences to a current experience. And when it's conflating, it will pull lots of things together that shouldn't necessarily be pulled together. And again, this is a way to save processing capacity and try and help you make a decision by shortcutting any of those complex decision-making processes that might utilize lots of calories. It'll also condense information and satisfy. So it'll smoosh information together that probably shouldn't be smooshed together. And it'll take the most important parts, or what it deems are the most important parts. And it will do things like satisfy. So it'll choose the most satisfactory option, or the easiest, or the first option, rather than the best option, right? And then it'll do things like it'll generalize and double down. So it'll make massive stereotypes over massive populations, and it'll do this with options you might be choosing from. And rather than going and finding new information, it will just collate information to the stuff that it already has existing. So if you take a look at this, it's not a list of good things that your brain is doing. Right? And if you think about your consumers and you think about the process that your consumers are going through when they're purchasing, this ain't a good time for us to be businesses who are trying to make people make the best choices possible, because our brains are going to get lazy in the process. So when you take a look at this list, the thing that I want everybody to remember is that our brains aren't out to get us. They're trying to help us survive, right? That is all that they're trying to do. And we have to remember that our consumers' brains are trying to help them survive. And because of that, there are lots of corruptions that happen. And those corruptions and those errors and all of these little things that the brain is doing that aren't necessarily good for making complex decisions, and complex decisions is pretty much anything we have to do in the modern world, that's when bias happens. And bias, cognitive bias, the thing we're talking about here today, are really all the little corruptions that your brain makes in the decision-making process. They're all the errors that happen as a result. Now, there are a specific reason that cognitive bias happens. So there was some fantastic theorizing. It's now backed by some neuroscience that I'm going to take you into. Yes, we're going to do it. You're going to see brain scans. It's going to happen. So there's a fantastic bit of work done by the lovely, I've completely forgotten the names, Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. See, it's early in the morning. It just went straight out my head. So they said that there was the reason we have all of these corruptions and errors is because we utilize something called system one and system two, right? This is our theory of understanding and taking in information in the world around us. And they said that we have these two different systems that we utilize to see the world around us and to understand the world around us. They said that the system number one is a fast system and system number two is a much slower system, hence their book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Now, I do want to point out that these guys are psychologists. They won the Nobel Prize for this theory in economics because of the impact that this theory has on our decision making and therefore how this impacts economics in the long term. So these guys know what they're talking about. And a lot of people will 100% have read this book or have tried to read it because it's a little bit dry, I must say. So I'd suggest you read the summaries instead. It's top tip. So system one is basically so fast that it's automatic, whereas system two is a much more manual process. And they like to call system one the autopilot and system two the pilot, which gives you a little bit of an indication as to where they believe the power is in these systems. Now, the real difference between these systems is that system one takes in 11 million bits of information per second, which is a lot, and system two only takes in 40 bits of information per second. Now, that's quite the disparity between the two systems. The only reason that system one can take in that much information because of the fact it uses a series of rules and mental to understand the world around us. Now, these rules and mental shortcuts are called heuristics. They're called algorithms. So the brain has algorithms that run. An algorithm is a process that helps us do things that pretty much never goes wrong. So things like drinking some water or eating something or going through the process of doing these things that we hardly ever get wrong, those are algorithms. But then we have heuristics, and heuristics are groupings of rules and mental shortcuts. These tend to go wrong sometimes. And when they go wrong, they lead to cognitive biases. So we have all these rules and mental shortcuts that help us take in that much information and understand it, but also filter out the stuff that isn't important. Whereas system two is intensive, it's effortful, it uses calories, it doesn't have those rules and mental shortcuts. And really the brain only wants to do that when system one can't get involved and it can't understand the information. Now, I always get to the point where whenever I'm doing a talk, people are like, okay, this is just a theory. Do we have any evidence behind this theory? Yes, we do. Thank you to neuroscience and fMRIs and image scanning and all this great stuff. We actually do have some proof of these two different systems. So here are some brains that we can take a look at. So this was a fantastic study done by Gul and Dolan back in 2003. And this gave us the first real concrete evidence of the two different systems that the brain utilizes. So while this is the most accepted theory, this was the first evidence that really proved that this is exactly what's happening in the brain. So what was happening here was they took people through a series of syllogisms. And syllogisms are things where you get people to perform logically correct tasks. So a syllogism would be something like, if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C, right? Now that doesn't make any sense, I get that. But breaking that down a little bit, if a cat is a mammal and a dog is also a mammal, then a cat equals a dog. Right? So this is a logical error that our brain is making. And people are like, oh, that's very obvious. But let's break that down once more. So if a crow is black, and I have a black bird inside a cage, then that bird must be a crow. So it is a jump that our brain is making. We do this more often. I have a very beautiful friend. She can have any man she wants. total logical fallacy. We don't have evidence for that, right? So these are things that our brains are making little jumps where they go in through that reasoning process. And rather than going through all the steps, they make a jump to the next step because we're bringing in information from previous experiences. So what these guys did was they got people to go through this task. And they said, okay, we know that there's a cognitive bias that's going to happen in that syllogism. And we know that if we give people a process where belief comes in, and they bring in previous beliefs from previous things, that they're probably going to make an error in that reasoning. And they gave them these two different options. Now, the important thing to take a look at is on the left-hand side, when it was belief-neutral reasoning. So when belief didn't come into the process and didn't cause people to have that bias, that's the brain activation that we got on the left-hand side. When there was belief-laden reasoning, a different part of the brain activated. So when that cognitive bias happened, a shortcut happened, and rather than having the sections that we wanted to activate, we had a different section of the brain activate. Then they go in, let's go further. Let's give people enough information and context to stop that bias from happening. What happens in the brain? And a different part of the brain activated, so that's section C. And then when they gave them that information and the bias was so strong that it overcame that context, that's when we had section D activate. So we can really see that when a bias happens, a different part of the brain is activating to when a bias isn't happening. And this is our real concrete evidence that this is happening. And these have been replicated time and time again. So they're really good quality studies. So it's exciting for us to be able to see that neuroscience, but also to know that this bias is happening all the times in our brains and we need to be countering that. So I know this is a little bit heavy, so let's have some fun with it. Like, I don't like to talk about system one and system two because quite frankly, it's a little bit boring. It's a little bit dry. It's a tongue twister. And people are like, oh no, what's the difference between the two systems again? So let's break it down, right? I like to call system one, the minions, right? And system two grew from Despicable Me. Now, if you ain't seen that movie, then you need to go watch it. That's your homework. Forget everything else. That's what you got to do. So the main premise of this movie is that Gru is this like cognitive overlord. He's like this mastermind. He is this amazing criminal who has all these dastardly plans, but he's only one man. So he can only do so much. So he either kind of employs or enslaves this little race of yellow people. I'm not entirely sure which one, but he has all these little yellow guys running around with their variable amount of eyes doing all of the stuff for them. Now, the problem with the minions is that they're not very clever. And it's sort of like a one minion, one job sort of a deal. That's it. You know, you give one minion has a spanner, one minion has a hammer, and magically with thousands of different minions, they manage to create warheads, which he seems to have lots of. So the whole process, when you take a look at it, that's our brains. It's exactly how our brains work. Each rule is a minion and they can't do too much. They can only do that one thing that's in front of them at that point in time. Whereas Gru is this cognitive overlord. He's this clever being and he feels like he's running the show. He isn't running the show. The minions are running the show. And the premise, sorry, I've just seen Simon's comment in the chat. This made me laugh. Yes, the minions do like to say bottom. The premise of the movie is effectively things going wrong because the minions get stuff wrong. That's exactly what our brain is like. You give the minions a task that they can't handle with, it either goes in the trash or all hell breaks loose. And the challenge with this is that minions rule. Like the minions are the people who are creating the things to happen. And when we take a look at this, we like to think of ourselves as these cognitive misers, these cognitive overlords who are in control most of the day. In reality, Gru is only in control around 15% of the day. The rest of the time, brains are in minion mode. The other 85% of the time, we're relying on those rules and mental shortcuts to get through the day because our brain doesn't want to utilize the calories. It wants to put a shortcut in place for absolutely everything. So the minions do rule, but the minions make mistakes, and those mistakes are our cognitive biases. And when we do our marketing, who do we create our marketing for? We try to create our marketing for Gru all the time. But in fact, we need to get attention of the minions first. And we need dominion-proof information to make sure that we're not falling foul of all the biases that the brain is making. So let's talk about them biases, because all the biases all belong to us. There's a tiny little geeky reference in there. So effectively, we have more than 300 cognitive biases that happen to us on a day-to-day basis, or that could happen to us in various different scenarios. Now, this is a fantastic piece of work done by the Cognitive Bias Codex, which you can find on Wikipedia if you take a look at biases. And he grouped all of the various different biases together. Now, he only pays attention to, in the same way that I only pay attention to, around 180 biases that have good scientific validity behind them. I absolutely love the way that he grouped this together. My new book is based on this, about the fact that we have four different areas in which cognitive bias is going to happen. If we have a capability we have to remember or recall information, bias is going to happen. If we have too much information in front of us and we have to make a decision, bias is going to happen. If we don't have enough meaning and context around that decision, bias is going to happen. And if we need to act quickly, bias is going to happen. Now, I think if you take a look at those four different areas and think to yourself, is that going to happen for my audience? Yes, yes, that's going to happen. Bias will happen throughout the process and it will ruin your conversions. So let's take a look at some of those in particular. Now, I like to group the four different areas. They're more important having the groupings than going into the individual biases, but it's also fun to do the individual biases. So we're going to do it. So let's take a look at those conversions that actually the crutches that the brain is using that might be killing your conversions. Now, the first one, confirmation bias, right? This is the worst one. This is the one that's not only responsible for people ignoring your very important information that you've put together painstakingly on all of your various different blogs and podcasts and all that kind of stuff, because it might be a bit contrary to what they want to see, but it's also responsible for great polarization when it comes to things like politics, right? So confirmation bias is a bad one. And this is where we go out and we will find the information that matches our belief and we'll hold on to that instead of the information that is actually going to help us and get to the point that we might need to get to. So confirmation bias is a really bad one. This is particularly bad for businesses, because we're drawn to information that is going to confirm our beliefs, and we're also going to ignore any contrary information. So remember how that amazing piece of business advice that people give you, create products for the things that people want, not the things that they need. Well, confirmation bias is the reason that that is good advice. It's really hard as an expert when you know that someone needs something, but you also know that they want something else. It's hard to create marketing that matches up with that. And we'll do really weird things. Like we'll take ambiguous information that doesn't go either way, and we'll just apply that to our own belief instead. We will bias that own information. This was originally identified by Peter Wasson. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his surname correctly. Don't know if he's French. Don't know why I've given him a French inflection on his surname. He probably isn't. But we kind of seek to confirm our own hypotheses rather than deny them. And he created this fantastic experiment called this card experiment that really shows how people do that, which means we are bad scientists. So effectively, yeah, it's a problem for us. But if your information doesn't align with what someone actually sees, then it's going to bring out this bias. Okay, so you have to be prepared for that. And a couple of the ways that you can mitigate for this is that we can manage this process with critical thinking. So we can get people to get into a critical thinking consumption routine. And we can give people carefully laid out guides that help them understand the information around us and get them into the critical thinking process. The only way that you're going to mitigate this. But if they don't want to do it, you're going to have a really hard time giving them that. Okay, so confirmation bias is one we have to be really careful of. Then we have ambiguity bias. This is a killer for your sales pages, right? We choose things where we know what the outcome is going to be over anything particularly vague, even if the vague option is far better. So consumers that can't really understand the benefits of your product And the way that your product or service is going to be delivered and all the things that are going to happen, all those critical components, they can't understand that. They're not going to choose you, even if you're better than the competition. The competition can give a really clearly outlined, this is the things that are going to happen, and they're going to win that business because the brain doesn't want to make a vague choice. It will rather not make a choice if the information is vague than make a choice for something that is vague. So the best thing that you can do for your sales pages and for your marketing materials is walk people through the process, help them understand the context, right? So ambiguity bias is terrible for your sales pages. Then we have a real baddie, especially when you're having to challenge industry norms, and that is anecdotal fallacy. Probably one of my favorite memes. I don't always use anecdotal fallacies, but when I do, it's using an isolated experience instead of a sound argument. I bet we've never done that in an argument ever. So the brain is catered towards stories. It likes stories. It likes little bits, because if you think about the fact that that's how we've passed information for tens of thousands of years towards one another, it's going to put undue weighting on little snippets of stories, right? So-and-so's sister's friend's thing did this, and that's why it's important. So we have to always make sure that people are going to prefer personal experiences over any of the data. So this is often used in arguments, but if you are backing up your information with data, this is very important when there is clinical data that is being presented, and if you're putting lots of data driven stats in things, the brain might just skip over that information and go straight for a fallacy instead. So how do you mitigate that? Bring the human in. Okay, so if you have testimonials from people, if you have case studies from people, show them a picture, show them that there is a human being behind this little bit of information. Always keep someone there. Put the information in the context of a story, which is why hero-driven case studies are so much better than dry case studies that just walk through all the facts. So bring in the person if you have to present data. And I always love data, so just bring that stuff in and bring it all together. Then we have loss aversion. I bet no one's done this, spent way more money on a product because you get free shipping than going for the cheaper option where you have to pay for the shipping, because it just feels rude having to pay for shipping now, doesn't it? So we will avoid loss at the expense of gaining. Okay, so even though, if we gain something, it just doesn't feel as good to the brain as avoiding loss does. We feel loss far more than we feel gaining. So if we lose out on an experience, we feel that impact 2 to 4 times more than we feel a positive impact of gaining something. So the brain is really averse to losing out on something. And as a result, it will make all sorts of ridiculous things instead of actually doing the thing that needs to do. So this actually forms the basis of prospect theory and the endowment effect. For those of you who are a little bit more sort of interested in the economics, you can go check that out. But we see this in monkeys as well, just by the way. So we can see that this is an evolutionary loss in the brain. It's not something that just humans feel. So this is something from Tversky and Kahneman that they showed really, really clearly. So we need to be really clear with our products and services that people could lose out on stuff, but not in a spammy way. So we need to help them understand the risks that are involved with things instead. And so we need to help them be really clear on that as well, which is why I love a blog post that is titled 5 Reasons We Aren't a Good Fit for You, because goddammit, people are going to read that. They're going to read the living shit out of those blog posts, right? So anything where we can explain to people the mistakes that they might be making, or reasons that our services might not be a good fit, or things they need to watch out for in the industry, the brain likes that. It wants to consume that content. Now, I'm not saying that you constantly just feed that negative content to people, but I'm saying that you need to make it sure that people understand the risks evolve with this entire process. And that also means working with other products and services. Okay, here's my favorite one, the availability heuristic. Okay, so this is me. I love horror movies. I pretty much exclusively watch horror movies. So I always get to the point, like I've watched a horror movie and I hear a noise in the dark and I'm like, oh my God, that's me. It's me. Annabelle's coming for me. Even though I might not have watched Annabelle recently, that doll terrifies me. What the brain does is any information that is recent it says that's more important than other information, which is nonsense, right? Because maybe you learned something in school that's really important, but the stuff that you read on Reddit 5 minutes ago is now more important than anything else you may have come across, which is terrible, right? So effectively, if it can be recalled easier, then it must be important. This is what the brain is doing. If it can be remembered easier, then it must be more important than anything else, than all the other options. Do you think about the jingles that companies create, all these little things that happen? Effectively, that is what the brain is doing. It's recalling that information. That's why those little bits of advertising, repetitive advertising, work as a result of that. But what we need to be thinking about when it applies to us and our smaller businesses, and we're not BMW that has a massive advertising budget where it can just spank lots of money on repetitive information and ads that have the same thing going on and on again. One of my favorite ones, the sound that anybody that watches Law and Order will know, dun dun, right? If you watch Law and Order, you know exactly where that sound comes in. That is a heuristic that the brain is utilizing. That's not an important noise, but apparently it is, because you hear that anywhere else. Anyone who has, yeah, sonic effect, exactly, Raju, you're clever. Exactly, there are tons of little things where the brain can recall information that's going to come through. So what we need to remember is, how memorable are you? So the content you're creating, how memorable is it? Can people recall you when they think about your brand, your products, and your services? And remember, building a relationship means that you can be recalled easier. And we are loss averse. So if we can't recall you, does that mean that you're not as important as something else, and that maybe you're a risk? We avoid ambiguity. So if there is ambiguity around stuff and they can't recall that information, can you see how the cognitive biases start to compound and start to cause a significant problem for you? So how do you get more mental real estate and build those stronger foundations effectively? Okay. So this is one that's not really a cognitive bias that consumers are going to be falling foul of. This is one you're going to be falling foul of as the marketer. We know what we know. And when we explain things to our consumers and explain things to our needs, we forget that we know all of that stuff. And that's called the curse of knowledge. We don't tend to put ourselves in other people's shoes, because this stuff is really, it's really simple to us. It's obvious, right? And we forget that we have this wealth of experience that we're sitting on, which means that we forget that all of the little parts, the little component parts of our products and services that make it so unique and make it so good, we don't talk about that to people. We don't give them that information because we forget that it's amazing, just because it's simple to us. So this is where we need to minion-proof things really well. We need to just make sure that when we're explaining things to consumers, we're explaining it to them in a way that they understand, not in a way that makes sense to us or our peers. If we're creating content for our peers, we'll be really guilty for this, but we need to break it down to the component parts so that they can understand the context, because context is king, right? So don't fall foul of the curse of knowledge. Just make sure you're giving people that true context. Now I'm gonna get on my high horse here, and this is where I'm gonna swear. So marketing really sucks, and as marketers, we really, really suck. And by really suck, I mean that we are a massive bag of dicks, and we are really, really horrible to our consumers and everybody around us. And for all the marketers getting really, really defensive, don't get defensive. You know it's true. That's why you're here in this environment with other lovely people. Now, the reason that marketing particularly sucks, and the reason that all of us in this room are collective dickheads together, is the fact that if you give us a channel, we will ruin it. We will ruin that channel with advertising, and we'll ruin it with tons of stuff, and we'll give it back to you and go, it's broken, even though we ruined it. And if you give us a bias, we will exploit it. Every time I go into a conference and I go and speak on forensic psychology or anything, I will also see a ton of other talks that are about psychological hacks that you can employ to coerce and trick your audience into doing things they may not necessarily want to do, right? So we totally suck. And the reason we suck is we focus on these hacks and these tricks and these coercions, and we're interested in it. We're excited by it. We will ignore strategy in favor of quick wins because that's more exciting, right? And we are biased around our own biases. And what I mean by that is that marketing is a test pit of the bandwagon effect, right? We're constantly excited about the new next thing that's happening. And we suffer really, really badly from in-group bias. Well, because other marketers are doing it, it's okay. It's not okay. And also, we're really guilty of information bias. So we will just go and collect more information and look for more information, even when we have enough information. And really, that's because we're controlled by our own minions. So all this information that I've given you, I hope you've noticed that I've not given you any of these little hacks that you put on a sales page and it just quickly increases your conversions. That's not what I'm after. Instead, I'm giving you things where I'm going, the brain is making a mistake. Here's how you help it stop making those mistakes, right? Remember that biases are things that are going wrong with consumers, right? You don't want to lean into inaccuracies and errors that the brain is making. Instead, you want to help your consumers be more conscious and make a better choice. All right. So we need to break out of this mold marketing has put itself into, and we need to be better marketers because we have a responsibility to our consumers to help them make the best choices possible. And that is my soapbox, and that is a hill I will die on. So let's talk about how we stop that from happening. So let's run through some quick bias busters, right? We're going to bias be gone this entire process. So remember those four different areas. Too much information. This is where people filter things out, where people will pick the most meaningful bits of information and where we will be drawn to things that stick out or slightly funny. And also we will notice things that are primed in memory and are repeated often. And we will do things like confirm our own beliefs. So when we have too much information, you know that your consumers are going to do all of these things. Guaranteed it's going to happen. So what can we do? What are we going to be doing about this process? We're going to simplify our information. We're going to make it easy. We're going to make it contextual. We're going to make it simple for the brain to understand what's happening. We're going to make it minion friendly. And we're going to repeat the important information. That copywriting rule of threes, tell them what you're going to tell them and tell them what you've just told them, is really, really important because it helps the brain understand what's important, right? How many times have I said the word context so far? I'm hoping that context is the word that's going to stick out the most for everybody. Provide context. So if we've got too much information, we're going to simplify and we're going to repeat information if there are going to be decisions that are going to be clouded by a dirge of information. And then on top of that, if there is not enough meaning, Roger's my favorite person at the moment because every time I look at the chat, I see something from Roger. And he just put kiss theory in there. I love you. This is fantastic. It might just be total coincidence, but there are little things that keep coming up. I think someone's been doing the research. I'm very impressed right now, which is great. So when we've got not enough meaning, we will do things like we'll connect the dots. We will find stories in sparse data that do not exist. We fill in those gaps and we generalize and fill in characteristics and we create stereotypes out of things. We'll also oversimplify numbers and data and we'll project experiences, past information, past learning onto future things. So if you know that there's not going to be enough meaning, then provide that meaning and be explicit about things. So don't ever leave ambiguity to happen. We don't want that to happen. We want to provide context when we provide that information. All right, next one. When we have a need to act fast, we will be overconfident in our own abilities. That is guaranteed to happen. We will favor the immediate over the relatable or the relatable over anything else, which means that we're not going to make good decisions. We also prefer to complete things. This is the sunk cost fallacy, where if we put lots of effort into the process, even though we should stop doing it, we're going to carry on doing it. And we also prefer autonomy and status. So we like to be autonomous, but we don't want to disrupt the status quo, which in itself is a massive, creates a lot of cognitive dissonance for people. But that's what the brain's up to, right? And we'll avoid ambiguity at all costs. So if you know that your consumer needs to act fast and they're in that moment of having to make a quicker decision or a pressured decision, summarize information for them and highlight the really, really important information. Okay, so just make sure that we're giving people that context. And when we need to recall information or encode information and create new experiences, we will only keep what is useful. And we will pick out a few things and we will discard everything else. And we will save space in the brain and we will transfer and conflate information. So if you know that you need people need to remember stuff in order to make a decision, or you want them to sort of encode this into their memory banks, keep it simple. That's the KISS right there, and give them the big picture, right? These are all ways that we can de-bias the process and help people make better decisions. And all the way through, the best advice I can make, I can give to you guys is to make it minion friendly. Just make it really easy and continually provide that context and frame control all the way through. So in making minions happy, just remember that minions love specificity. So one of the best things you can do is understand the awareness stages that consumers are going to go through. That's your homework, is to understand those awareness stages. And Joe, I'll give you a resource for everybody to help them understand those awareness stages. But you can understand the awareness stages. You can be specific to the stage that someone is looking for that information. All right. So rounding up. What are we going to do? We're going to be aware of bias at all times, right? We're going to bias bust. We're not Ghostbusters, we're bias busters. I need a t-shirt. Someone designed me a t-shirt that says bias busters on the front of it. I need that. Then provide context all the way through. We're going to lean into consciousness, not coercion, because we don't want to be a giant bag of dicks anymore. We want to be good to our consumers. And we're going to KIMF. So we're going to keep it minion friendly at all times. All right, guys. So I know that's been a big FOSS tour. I am making a little bias buster cheat sheet at the moment. So you guys can go and check that out and download that. It'll be ready in a few weeks when I get some time to finish it off. All right, Joe, are you ready?
Oh my God. That was so amazing. Like people do not need coffee this morning, Kendra. That was incredible. And actually Sarah's right, that did go so quickly. I just looked at my watch. I was like, oh my God, like that was incredible. And like I hope you are keeping these chat messages up on your screen right now, because you are getting the world's biggest ego boost, I think.
That is amazing. Thank you guys. I'm gonna fit out the door and I can breakfast in a moment.
Awesome. Honestly, such an amazing session. I saw at least one comment from someone saying it was the best webinar I've seen all year.
I'll take that.
Absolutely. 100%. There's some lovely, lovely questions that are coming from the community, actually. So let's give folks the opportunity to have them answered. And one has just flicked to the top, actually. So I haven't had the chance to read it. So I'm going to be reading it at the same time as asking it. So that's always safe, right?
Always.
So the question is from Oliver. And Oliver asks, internal stakeholders always love certain marketing tactics, even though they show objectively poor ROI. For example, trade shows. Is this an example of ambiguity bias? And if so, what can we do about it?
I would say this is probably an example of information bias, seeking out information even though we don't need it, which is what we tend to do. The best thing that we can do about it is have your North Star for what you need to do for your strategy. Tactics have their place. We can't execute strategy without tactics, but they shouldn't be our North Star. So if you have a North Star for something and you can compare your tactics to it, 100%. The other thing is that information bias, funnily, is combated with information. So if someone comes back from something and is like, oh, this is the thing that I'm going to do, give them a little bit of information as to why it probably won't work, and then just fight them with data. So fight them with ROI. So give them the information that they need, and just remember they're probably also going to be falling foul of a little bit of anecdotal fallacy, because if it is somebody that is going out and is like, okay, yes, I've heard this great talk and this person would work really well for their business, that is anecdotal fallacy, right? Because it's not applied to your own business. So effectively you just need to go out and find more information on that and help people see that that's probably not applicable to your business, which is really hard. It's a continual battle with marketing. It's focusing on the North Star stuff and not everything else. That's very exciting.
100%. I have a feeling that answer probably answers this next question, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless, because lots of people have given it a thumbs up, so it may well be the same answer. But do you have any tips on how to convince your boss that quick wins are simply not a thing? I have a feeling that a lot of us might be struggling with that approach right now.
It's true. marketing is so driven by quick KPIs, you know, things that don't actually move the needle in the long run. The best way that I've seen to kind of combat that within our own business and working with our own clients is to move the metrics that are the KPI driven ones. It's not a quick fix, but then it's a quick fix for quick fixes, right? So effectively, we like to focus on customer lifetime value. When you start to focus on customer lifetime value at a much deeper level, you stop doing very superficial KPIs and metrics, because the things that don't move customer lifetime value get dropped. And very frequently, all those short-term tactics don't move customer lifetime value. They might move some of the other things like ROAS and that kind of stuff. So we like to focus people onto that metric, which is where profitability is. So if you need to get the big boys involved in the process, talk about profitability and bring in all of the customer lifetime value things and show how focusing on customer lifetime value is going to give you that longer term thing. That's the way we've combated it, but it's not a quick fix because it takes time to get those things in place.
Yeah, spot on. But I think that's really smart, actually. I don't think, bizarrely, I've been doing this for however long I have, 5 years now. I don't think I've heard many people sort of eulogize, that's the wrong word, on the side of long-term metrics in either case. You know, whenever we do our planning as for a year as marketers, we do tend to focus on like the next 12 months or whatever it may be. You know, if you sort of take that long-term value, lifetime value view, then, you know, you could be speaking 3-5 years. But I mean, that's such an incredible way to think. I think that makes a lot of sense. I can't believe no one said that before, but it makes a lot of sense.
So. Well, I mean, we put a long-term nurture campaign in place for a client that increased their conversion rates by 351%, but it didn't happen overnight. It took 18 months to get there, you know, and if they hadn't had that belief in us, they wouldn't have given that time. If you think about the amount of time that took, but that turned them from, you know, small bit of profitability to a very big chunky profitability, you know, for people who stick around for a lot longer and are spending more money every time they do spend. So it's well worth it. It's just that business has to want to make that change, and you have to be able to, you know, back up the data effectively. And when you move to those longer metrics, it becomes really obvious that those short-term metrics aren't moving the dial at all.
Mm-hmm. There was a great chat comment there. I mean, like, it's not necessarily on the focus of this conversation as in on neuroscience, but I think it's an interesting thread nonetheless, which is that one of the chat messages says that the challenge with lifetime value is often how to measure it. Could you give us like a quick 20-30 seconds on how you've approached that in the past, because I think that's really interesting.
So what we've done is we always take a baseline. Let's take a look at your data and work out what your customer lifetime value actually is. Mm-hmm. And then we settle on a metric that we will utilize, because there's lots of sort of small changes that you can make to how you measure customer lifetime value. But for the most part, the basic metric is, it's how long a customer is with you, how much they spend over that period of time, minus how much it has taken to bring them on. That's whether that's through advertising or whether through sales costs or et cetera, right? That's it very, very basically. And then we measure what that is on average, and then we measure whether anything is actually impacting that. So do we put a campaign, a re-engagement campaign in place? Do we put RFM, so recency, frequency, monetary value campaigns that encourage people back to the fold? Do we put a long-term nurture in place that increases engagement and therefore increases the likelihood that someone is going to purchase? And then demand generation is my big thing. Demand generation marketer is measured over the entire life cycle, not just the acquisition of the leads. They're measured over the conversion of the leads and how long those leads stay, or how long those customers stay as a result. So therefore, if you're a demand generation marketer and you're working in that train, your job is to make sure that those people stay for longer. And sales needs to be part of that process. So sales needs to be measured on the customer lifetime value of their leads, not just on that initial expenditure. And that means changing some of your bonus structures as well, if you have a sales driven business. So there's a lot that goes into it, and it can be a big shift for businesses, but it's well worth it, because that's where the profits are. I mean, Bain & Co did some great research, and they showed that businesses could increase their profits by 95% with a 5-15% focus on retention of customers rather than acquiring new customers.
Nice.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's mad. I mean, it's that old. It's the shiny thing, isn't it? To get new people in all the time. But you're spot on. That retention thing is huge, and our responsibility as well. I firmly believe that anyway. Yeah. Cool. Thank you for sharing that, Kendra. That's really useful. There's some great chat comments coming in on that as well. So If you got access to that research, in fact, it would be really useful. I don't know whether you could dig it out. So the next question, I absolutely love this. It comes from an anonymous, so we can't give them credit, but I think it's a really great question, which is, can you overuse this knowledge? So stepping back into the neuroscience world and feel overwhelmed with it. Where is the safe spot to enjoy it from a marketer's perspective?
In part, that is why I don't go down to the individual biases. I like to parade the individual biases out because they're fun to look at. And everybody goes, oh, yes. And that's good fun. But that is why I focus on those four areas rather than focusing on the individual biases. So I will go, okay, if I know that there is going to be too much information and it's going to be hard to make a decision, then I'm going to focus on trying to de-bias in that. So when I'm taking a look at this kind of stuff, there are some core principles I take a look at. I take a look at the purchase formula, how we make those purchase decisions and how they impact marketing activities. I take a look at awareness stages, and I take a look at those four areas of bias. And if you take those three principles into consideration, you're going to be having a good time. You don't need to go that much deeper than that. But when people start optimizing their sales pages for individual biases, you're getting into trouble. Rather look at those groupings and just focus on making sure that you're giving people what they need to stop that bias from happening, than optimizing for individual biases.
Nice. I love that. That's almost like the, I guess it's quite similar to SEO. If you're going to draw an analogy, you know, you can optimize for each of the, you know, the reported 200 metrics, which of course is a load of rubbish anyway, but you know, the 200 metrics that people have speculated that gets SEO ranking, or you can write something for a human being and you know, you're probably going to have a much better result anyway. So I love that. Thank you for sharing that answer. So next question from Aoife. Aoife asks about ambiguity bias and whether that includes information that is quite technical and meaty. And if the answer is yes, what advice would you offer for sort of technical and meaty content in blog posts?
I love that. It's an astute question. Yes, so it will definitely happen when there are more technical decisions to be made. So if you have a decision that is going to involve, you know, people understanding the implications of various options or how things will be applied, what I like to do is, remember, don't fall foul of the curse of knowledge. If you are writing in any of those spheres, don't assume what people already know, but always just making sure that you're giving people the information that they need to know. So breaking things down, giving people basic levels of information, and then moving into something that's a bit more complex. It is a skill set, making complicated things easy to understand. And it is a skill set that everybody should develop if they are working in those technical or you know, slightly meatier industries. So definitely breaking things down to their component parts and highlighting the stuff that is really, really important. If you spend the time helping people understand what all the component parts are and then highlighting the really important bits, they will really appreciate that, especially if they're not an expert. If you are writing for other experts, though, so if you are writing, let's say, technical specifications for manufacturing for engineers, don't hold back. They know exactly what you're going on about and they want that additional information. So why technical writing is so important in these very, very specific industries. So yeah, I would go ham if you're writing for experts, but if you're writing for other stuff, break it down and highlight the information that's important for them. And that is a skill set in its own right.
Nice. And I guess you could probably also loop in what you were speaking about with the awareness, sort of different types of awareness. So you could even write a blog post for the completely unaware right the way down. You could almost get five blog posts on the same topic in degrees of thing, if you were going to be if you had the resource to produce that, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. That would be amazing.
I love that. The next question, I think, is sort of a question that sort of summarizes the whole talk. in a way, but I think it's worth addressing, particularly as the clock behind me says 9:28. So it might be a nice way to sum up today's session as well, which is from Yolanda. And Yolanda asks, could you use the knowledge about bias to generate bias in your favor? And if so, what are the implications? It might be a nice way to round off.
Yes, you can do that, but I think it's morally and ethically repugnant. You can definitely do that. You can, and a lot of businesses do. You know, there's pricing tables that have very specific things. They're using the anchoring bias to get you to make a decision that you wouldn't necessarily make. If you think of all of Russell Brunson stuff, where it's like, you know, you can buy this for $59 and it's worth $5,000. That's loss aversion, right? There are tons of things that you can do to build into this to manipulate people. My stance on it is that that wouldn't get past an ethics community in psychology. And if you can't get past the ethics community, then you shouldn't be doing it. So I want to be good to my audience, and I want them to make decisions that I know that they would make even if I wasn't manipulating a bias. So I want them to make the right decision that is right for them, because that gives me longer customer lifetime value. So I want to be good by them. So you can definitely manipulate biases. I just think it's wrong. So I'm not going to encourage people to do that as a result.
I love that, Kendra. I think that's a great way to sum it up. I mean, use this knowledge, use it, know it, tailor to it, but don't get too much in the weeds, but also use it with sensitivity and with the best of intentions to help people. I think that's a very, very nice way to round up today's session. Thank you so, so much. Like, again, you are just getting all the praise in the chat feature. So thank you so much for spending the time with us today, Kendra. Like, your energy has been phenomenal. And likewise, a big, 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 big thank you to everyone for making that chat feature just light up throughout the duration of the session. Honestly, it adds such an amazing element to it. It really does.
Very inspiring.
So, you know, thank you to everyone. Thank you to everyone involved. My one ask, or two asks, please make sure to share your big takeaway from today's session on your socials. And then say a big thank you to Mark from Geosk and the rest of our sponsors also, if you have the time. That makes a huge difference to the marketing meetup. And it's a really nice thing to do as well. So thank you, everyone. Hope you have a lovely day. Hope this Tuesday morning has started off in the best way possible, and we'll see you soon. Thanks, Kendra.